The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, we've reached the end of an era in Israel this morning. Former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres died at the age of 93, this after suffering a debilitating stroke 2 weeks ago. And now all of the outpouring of support and encouragement comes in from all over the world. It's amazing, really, in an era when so many Israeli diplomats come under fire constantly. Shimon Peres seems to escape much of that. Lots of praise and adulation. President Obama has agreed to attend the funeral this Friday. Former President Bill Clinton also will be in attendance. Leaders from all over the world, no doubt. This Friday, Peres was born in Poland. He lived a long life, as I said, 93 years of age. Born in Poland and then fled for what would later become Israel during the 1930s. And those in his family who stayed behind in Poland were murdered in the Holocaust. And then it wasn't long as after the establishment of Israel as a state that he became a leader in politics and in the military early on in his political life for the fledgling Israeli state. The young Peres played a vital role in shaping Israel's military. And his most significant achievement may have been the role he played in helping Israel to gain a nuclear deterrence in order to diminish the possibility of another Holocaust. There was a rush to build nuclear weapons so as to, the way the leaders at the time thought, to prevent another Holocaust from happening. The New York Times says he led the creation of Israel's defense industry, negotiated key arms deals with France and Germany, and was the prime mover behind the development of Israel's nuclear weapons. Quite a significant leader, a founding father for Israel, who looked to David Ben-Gurion as his mentor. That was Peres the Hawk. And then later in life, it was the elder statesman Peres, the Dove Peres, who became the architect of Israel's never-ending peace negotiations with the Palestinians. In fact, Peres suffered his stroke a couple of weeks ago on September 13th. And as it happens, that was the 23rd anniversary of that now famous, some would say infamous, handshake in 1993 between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn. And some people don't realize that Peres was there in the background that day. He wasn't the one shaking hands, but he was the one signing the agreement. Peres was the architect of the deal. His signature's on the agreement that pushed the Oslo Accords forward. And it was largely the result of Peres's work that Israel stopped designating the PLO as a terrorist organization. They stopped viewing Yasser Arafat as a terrorist, as a terrorist sponsor, and they started negotiating with Arafat. And this led to, as some of you might remember, it led to Peres, along with Yitzhak Rabin and Arafat, all three of them jointly together, they won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1994. Well, over the years, we've had a lot to say about that agreement. signed in September of 1993, brought together by, with the help and assistance of President Bill Clinton, my father, in the Jerusalem and Prophecy booklet, he said, the Jews continue to give land for empty promises of peace. It started in 1993 on the White House lawn with a handshake between the late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. There, Israel surrendered bits of that hard-won, strategically important land in hope that the Arabs could be simply bargained into giving up their goal of destroying Israel. So this long life of Shimon Peres, in many ways, it mirrors the life of the Jewish state. I mean, he's been around longer than the Jewish state. He was there in the 1930s, as I said, before the Jewish state was even established. The last of the founding fathers, the end of an era in the Atlantic. It calls Peres the last link to Israel's founding fathers. It says here the death of a statesman like Shimon Peres, who spent more than 60 years in public service, would mark a towering milestone in any nation. But in Israel, one of the world's younger states, it takes on particular significance as he represented one of the few remaining links to Israel's founding generation. Peres, who was 93, was a first-hand witness and often a central participant in every moment in its history. One of the last links to Israel's founding fathers. And I think it's interesting, too, that Shimon Peres was also one of the last remaining direct links between world leaders and Herbert W. Armstrong. Mr. Armstrong met with Shimon Peres at least one time that we know of, probably more. Back in the mid-1980s, Mr. Armstrong was very near the end of his life. He died in January of 1986. And he sat down to speak with Shimon Peres in 1985. This is clip number one.
Well, I'm sure that all of them, including myself, appreciate very much
what you are doing
for this city, old and new, to excavate, to participate, and God bless you.
How do you foresee conditions here in the Middle East now, in the immediate future?
I think we have a chance to break through the wall of belligerence. It's a very complicated business. But after a very long interval, there is a chance, and I think it is for us responsible people not to miss it.
Do you think that...
The first bit. I'll get to a second clip here in just a second. But Herbert Armstrong there asking Shimon Peres, who was prime minister at the time, you know, what's your take on the prospects for peace? And he said there that he thought that Israel had a chance to break through. And then Mr. Armstrong asked him or talked to him about another very interesting subject, as we'll get to here in just a second. But first, let me just go through a bit of this this piece in the Jerusalem Post. Most of the articles that are now flooding into the news media are glowing reports on this man's efforts to seek peace. And he certainly was a towering figure in Israeli society. But this one offers a fair bit more criticism, particularly with respect to the Oslo Accords. And it says here, this is by Tova Lazaroff, writing in the Jerusalem Post, it says, at a time when Israeli diplomats are often condemned on the international stage, Peres has been lauded as the clear voice of peace for his persistent belief that a better future is possible between Israel and its Arab neighbors, including the Palestinians. Among his most well-known achievements on that score are the 1993 Oslo Accords, which have defined the Israeli-Palestinian relationship for the last 23 years. So this is the track that Israel has been on. And as I say, we've written a lot about this in the Jerusalem and Prophecy booklet, as I just quoted to you from, and many other articles and items over the course of our writing, our history, this church with the trumpet and the many booklets, dozens and dozens of booklets that we've produced over the years. This post piece, though, says it was an agreement that launched a public and direct negotiations process with the Palestinians. It acted as an interim agreement which created a Palestinian government known as the Palestinian Authority. When it divided up, it goes on to explain that it divided up the West Bank into three sections, sections A, B, and C, and how that the Palestinian Authority was given autonomy over 40% of the West Bank. So it basically created a Palestinian state. It says here the agreement also provided a framework for Israelis and Palestinians to interact around issues of governance when it came to the West Bank. Although the talks never led to a two-state solution, Israelis and Palestinians still operate within many of the guidelines of the agreement. And then it goes on and talks about that day in September on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, and how that Peres was also there, and how that he played such a pivotal role in drawing up the agreement. It says here, in a speech in Davos in 2009, Peres recalled the angry Israelis who, in the aftermath of the signing of the accords, had taken to the streets with chants against him and Rabin of traitor and killer. For, of course, we know what eventually happened with Yitzhak Rabin. He was assassinated by one of his own, a fellow Jew, in, 1995? It says here, former Likud Foreign Minister Moshe Arens, who was an opponent of the Oslo, of Oslo from the start, said that the agreement would not have happened without Peres. So Peres was the one who was really the prime mover behind these negotiations, behind this agreement. And it quotes this Likud member saying, if it had brought peace to the country, then I would have told you that I was wrong and that it turned out to be a wonderful agreement, he said. But it did not bring peace, Arens added. It did not bring peace. Among its mistakes, he said, was that it allowed for the return of the arch-terrorist Arafat and legitimized a terrorist organization, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as the representative of the Palestinian people. He's spot on with that. This is the big flaw of the agreement. It legitimized a terrorist organization. It legitimized a terrorist leader that, to that point, Israel had shunned. It says here, the Oslo Accords elevated the PLO and made it a negotiating partner rather than allowing for a more homegrown local leadership to lead the charge for peace. And then it quotes Arens as saying, we brought these terrorists into the area and we foisted them onto the Palestinian population, and the result, well, we all know the result. We've seen it over the last 23 years. It quotes another Likud member, Moshe Feiglin, who expressed frustration that the right has been silent about Peres. He said it was because the right had not provided enough of an alternative to Oslo. It's as if Peres has immunity from criticism, Feiglin said. Why it is illegitimate to say anything? It's because the right has never proved a different narrative. So that's his take. He feels like the Likud party needed an alternative, another narrative. And then he goes on to say it doesn't matter how much damage Oslo has caused, or how much blood has spilled, or how much money has been wasted. You can't dare criticize it. Certainly not Peres. It says Peres is such an icon And the right hasn't come up with an alternative to his philosophy. Then it says here later, former Meretz party head, Yossi Bilin, who was deputy foreign minister in Rabin's government and was also instrumental in crafting the Oslo Agreement, said the problem was not the agreement, but the fact that it was not immediately transformed into a permanent one. So it wasn't the agreement that's brought on the violence since then. It's the fact that it was never finalized, I guess, is his take. But notice this. It says here, he recalled the first moment that he had gone into Perez's office after Rabin became prime minister in 1992 to report on the unofficial low-level talks that were taking place with the Palestinians. At the time, Perez was the foreign minister, so the low-level talks started the year before. And it says here, if he had told me I am not going to do anything about it, that would have been the end. But he understood the importance of our meetings with the PLO and was committed enough to go to Rabin, that's this individual, Bilin, who approached Perez, talked about the low-level talks, and said it was Perez who took the ball and ran with it. And he approached Rabin, and then the talks proceeded from there. The article here, this is the Jerusalem Post piece, it says Michael Bar Zohar, who wrote a biography of Perez that was published in 07, said that Rabin had never intended to involve Perez in any peace efforts with the Palestinians. Undeterred, Perez moved forward in small steps until he had a major role. So this was something Rabin wasn't really even intending to turn him loose on. But he kept moving forward, taking these small steps. And then ultimately he played a major role in these negotiations that were finally agreed to then, on that September day in 1993, on the White House lawn. One day, it says, Perez came to Rabin and said there are two professors who say they are in contact with low-grade PLO leaders, and they want to negotiate with them in Norway. Rabin said yes, and that's how it started. He kept Rabin in the picture all the time, Bar Zohar said. Rabin did not believe that anything would come of the talks, this author wrote. Yitzhak Rabin didn't believe that anything would come from it. A few days before the accord was to be signed, he instructed Perez's people to halt the negotiations because he feared that Arafat was trying to cheat Israel. So it all got started in Oslo, and a few days before it was about to be signed, Rabin said it needed to be halted because Arafat was, well, not someone that we could trust. It says Perez brought him back on track by focusing on the small details of what needed to happen in a way that allowed the process to move forward. So Perez kept it going. And it says neither Perez nor Rabin, however, realized that by signing the agreement with Arafat, they were actually, in a de facto way, already agreeing to the creation of a Palestinian state. And as was explained earlier in this piece, there were lots of Jews at the time that were just absolutely irate because of these negotiations. It says here, according to his calculation, the watershed moment in the peace process did not happen on the White House lawn, but 6 years earlier, in 1987, when Perez was foreign minister under Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. So this is when, really, the negotiations were off and running back in the late 1980s. Now, you go back to that clip with Mr. Armstrong, and he's there with Perez, who was prime minister at the time. He had sort of a rotating prime ministership with Shamir. And so in 1987, when Shamir's prime minister, Perez is now foreign minister, and he's the one that got some of the talks started. But it wasn't with the Palestinians in 1987. It was with the Jordanians. Now, go back to this exchange that Herbert Armstrong had with Shimon Peres in 1985. This is audio clip number two.
I think the king knows where he wants to arrive, but he didn't find it a way to do so.
I know he would like to have peace with you.
I think so.
Yes. I think last time I saw him was 2 years ago. and Mr. Begin was prime minister. I said to King Hussein, I would like to bring Mr. Begin over here in my airplane and have you come out to the plane, and my crew and myself and all of us would leave and leave you two on the plane and get acquainted. I know Mr. Begin well enough, I believe he would be glad to do it, and I know you would too, Your Majesty, if... And he began to laugh, and he says, yes, you're right, I would, if... But he would like to, if he could.
I think so, yes. I think that he has his eyes set on peace, but he has to negotiate many difficulties.
I hope you have the breakthrough that you spoke of.
We shall try very hard.
Thank you very much.
We owe it to our friends and to our posterity. We owe it. We shall try very hard.
Well, I can tell you this much. We're going to have more troubles all over the world. In the end, we're going to have world peace. Mm-hmm. It isn't going to come right away, though.
That's a fascinating exchange there between Herbert Armstrong and Shimon Peres back in 1985. Mr. Armstrong mentioning to him that his predecessor, one of them, Prime Minister Begin, how that and Mr. Armstrong was trying to bring King Hussein from Jordan and Begin together. And he told the king in Jordan that, you know, I wish I could just park my plane here and you two could meet on the plane and get to know each other and start with the negotiations. And then he tells Peres there, I hope you have a breakthrough. And Peres responded by saying, we're going to try very hard. And then Mr. Armstrong ending with, what God commissioned him to do, the message that he commissioned him to take all over the world, saying that we're going to have a lot more troubles in this world, but in the end then, finally, we're going to have peace. Now, let me take you back to this Jerusalem Post piece, this article written a week or two ago about the life of Shimon Peres and the negotiations that he was engaged in with the Palestinians. But before that, and again, this piece is citing a biography by Michael Bar-Zohar that was published in 2007 about Shimon Peres. And remember, it said that really the watershed moment of this peace process went back to not 1993 or 1992, in Norway, but in 1987, when Shimon Peres was the foreign minister under Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. So the article says here, Peres had met secretly in London with then-Jordanian King Hussein, and they agreed to start direct talks for the first time. For the first time. This was in 1987, the year after Mr. Armstrong died. And so Peres and King Hussein had come together, and they actually entered into direct talks for the first time. It says Hussein knew very well, as he told the American media, that he would not get back all of the West Bank and Jerusalem. This is, again, according to Bar-Zohar in the biography that was released in 2007. Ecstatic, Peres sent Bilin, then Foreign Ministry Director General, to intercept then U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz, who was in Finland on his way to Moscow, to update him on the sudden breakthrough. And so they got in touch with the Secretary of the State, the United States, George Shultz, and said, look, we've had a breakthrough. We've had a secret meeting in London. King Hussein, Shimon Peres. It says, Bilin arrived at midnight and woke up Shultz's assistant to show him the agreement. Shultz was so supportive that he called it a touchdown and was ready to start shuttle diplomacy between Jerusalem and Amman, I mean, the United States was right there behind it, ready to kick things off. Let's get this negotiated. Let's draw up a peace agreement between Israel and Jordan. Let's settle some of the disputes over the West Bank. And remember, King Hussein had said that he knew that it wasn't a deal that was going to result in getting all of the West Bank back or all of East Jerusalem. In any event, they talked, and negotiations for peace were moving forward. It says, but Shamir, notice this, Shamir, remember, is the prime minister at the time. Peres is foreign minister. Yitzhak Shamir is prime minister. And it says Schultz was so supportive, he was ready to start shuttle diplomacy right then and there. It says, but Prime Minister Shamir sabotaged the efforts by sending errands to Washington to sway Schultz not to support the initiative. This is according to Bar Zohar's biography. Until then, any agreements with regard to the territories Israel acquired in the Six-Day War had been done with Jordan. It says, soon after the London Agreement failed and Peres did not quit the government in protest, Hussein resigned from the process of negotiating with Israel about the West Bank. It was a move that gave Peres and then Rabin no choice but to deal directly with the Palestinians themselves. And so you have all of these disgruntled Palestinians in that territory, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip at the time. And of course, that region had belonged to Jordan prior to the Six-Day War. And the negotiations were going forward with Jordan to settle some of the disputes and to enter into a peace agreement with a king that Mr. Armstrong dearly loved, with a king that Mr. Armstrong told Peres, basically, you need to get together with him, you need to talk with him. But these talks going on in 1987, they were sabotaged, according to this biography, by Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, and it left Israel with, as the article says here, no choice but now to deal directly with the Palestinians. It says, until today, Peres fiercely defends the Oslo agreements and his thesis that there is a new Middle East. So it talks then about some of the negotiations that then followed, but not with King Hussein, negotiations that followed with Yasser Arafat and his henchmen. Now, let me go back to something that Herbert Armstrong had to say. You heard what he said in that last clip about King Hussein and Menachem Begin and what he was saying there to Shimon Peres. This is what Herbert Armstrong had to say about Yasser Arafat, among others, in this clip from 1982, clip 3.
What about the madmen we've already had in this world? There's some of them even today. What about Khomeini? If he isn't a madman, what do you call him? What about Arafat? He would blow up a whole airplane with women and babies on it that had nothing to do with a dispute, to settle a dispute with other people. Arafat wanted an interview with me. I refused. I won't talk to him. I talked to heads of state, and I'm going to be talking to the king of Greece on this next trip in a couple of weeks. Arafat, I don't want to talk to.
Arafat, I don't want to talk to. He wanted to talk to Mr. Armstrong, but Mr. Armstrong refused because this was a terrorist who would blow up a whole airplane with women and babies on it and think nothing of it. That's not someone you can sit down and negotiate with. And Mr. Armstrong would have none of it. And that's what Israel should have done after talks broke down with the Jordanians. They should have had nothing to do with Arafat or the PLO. Look at the wound that it's been since. Now, we know these prophets, if anything, they should have reached out to King Hussein again. But King Hussein, after it was made public, well, he denied it. He wanted it to be kept secret, these negotiations. And then when it was made public, it made him look bad. And so he walked away from it. If anything, Israel should have reached out to him again. As it is, like the JP points out, they were left with no choice but to deal directly with the Palestinians themselves. And that was a massive, massive mistake. A deadly wound. Notice what Martin Gilber said. This is the well-known historian. He wrote in his book, Israel, a History, in October 1986, in accordance with the rotation agreement, Shamir succeeded Peres as prime minister. This is about some of that same history from 87. It says, on April 1987, following the secret talks with King Hussein in London, Peres and Hussein reached an agreement outlining the method whereby a peace treaty could be negotiated between Israel and Jordan. The agreement went even further. The first part laid down that the Secretary General of the United Nations would invite the five permanent members of the Security Council and all the parties involved in the Arab-Israeli dispute to negotiate a settlement based on Security Council Resolution 242. Envisioned by Peres, the London Agreement offered a chance to break a 40-year deadlock, but Shamir, who opposed it, sent Moshe Ahrens, whom he had appointed to be in charge of the Arab affairs, to Washington. Ahrens informed Secretary of State George Shultz that the adoption of the agreement by the Americans would be seen by Shamir as an intervention in the internal affairs of Israel. The agreement was also leaked to the Israeli press, with the result that King Hussein, who had insisted that it be treated with great confidentiality, denied its existence. When Peres brought it up, or brought it to the Israeli cabinet for approval, the Likud members, including Shamir, opposed it, and the vote was a tie. The plan was therefore rejected. Martin Gilbert says, Shamir had been furious over Peres's initiative and with Peres personally. And so all of this internal disputing, as it turns out, within Israel, pretty much nuked the talks with Jordan. And then, to paraphrase what the Jerusalem Post said a week or two ago, it left them with no choice but to deal with the Palestinians directly, to deal with Yasser Arafat directly. And that's something that Peres did do, sad to say. And it led to the handshake in 1993. It led to the agreement that Shimon Peres signed. And my father, following that historic agreement, so many said at the time, my father wrote in his personal, November 1993, Yitzhak Rabin has stated publicly that Israel must come to terms with the Palestinians sooner rather than later. Why? Because Islamic fundamentalism is on the rise. Surely we must see a certain desperation in this treaty. You can see prophecies rolling along, being fulfilled. The intense pressure that was coming upon Israel. Talks broke down with Jordan in 1987. Now we're left with the Palestinians. And then you've got this rise of Islamic fundamentalism. The rise of radical Islam. I mean, we've got to do a deal sooner rather than later, even if it means saying Arafat's no longer a terrorist. At least he's more secular. And that was a grave mistake. That was a grave mistake. They thought, well, we've got to come together with Arafat because of radical Islam. Well, my father went on to talk about the impact of this radicalization, the impact it was having on the Middle East. He said today, this is again 1993, 23 years ago, my father wrote, "Today, the radical Islamic movement is causing other nations to fear, even motivating peace treaties. But these treaties are destined to fail. The deadly delusion that all problems can be solved by negotiation is going to lead Israel and the U.S. to disaster." Now, that spread of fundamentalist Islam that my father was talking about there, I mean, it did indeed become a force throughout the region. It is right now. It's dominating the region. And yet, it going back to 1993 in its earlier stages, well, you see what it really pressured Israel into doing. Negotiating peace with a terrorist like Yasser Arafat, who would blow up an entire airplane full of women and babies and not think anything of it. My father wrote, why would the Israelis trust the greatest terrorist in the Middle East, Yasser Arafat, to protect them from terrorism? Why would you trust a terrorist to protect us from terrorists? It says they have more than enough power to protect themselves, but they lack the will to use it. That's because God, it says, has broken their will. Now, what's interesting, as I say, when you look at the long life of Shimon Peres and what he was involved in early on, building up Israeli defenses, one of the more prominent influences behind the development of Israel's nuclear power. I mean, Israel has the power. It has enough power to protect itself, but it also lacks the will. And so over time in this state that was established really in so many miraculous ways, God was behind it. And God intervened to save Israel there at the establishment of the state in 1967. Then again in 1973. But Israel doesn't win anymore. Israel doesn't win anymore. Israel's backtracking. Israel's retreating. Israel's pulled out of Lebanon, of Gaza. Israel's given up so much of this territory already. Look at what's happened just since that agreement was signed. Speaking of Gaza, speaking of Lebanon, the buffer zone that it had up there, the Second Intifada, the construction of hundreds of miles of security fences, huge barriers. It's all just as God prophesied it would be. It's a deadly wound. It says in Hosea 5:13, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound. It's a deadly wound. If you look at that word wound in the Hebrew, Jacinius Lexicon defines it as the pressing together, binding up of a wound. Here it's used figuratively, of a remedy applied to the wounds of the state. My father has written that the remedy is the wound. This was supposed to solve everything. This was supposed to fix all of the problems. Entering into a peace agreement with Yasser Arafat and the PLO. And as it turns out, that very agreement in itself is the wound. Is the wound. You look at the long line of concessions that Israel has made based on the premise that the Palestinians would finally be satisfied and turn into friendly neighbors. Just hasn't happened. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back. Oh, my God.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges. Today, terrorism, rocket attacks, and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem, and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today. Please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
About a week ago, I referred to this article by George Friedman, Germany Again. He got back into it again, and he made his apologies at the start of this piece for having to return to the subject of Germany. But as he said, I mean, right now, Germany's the pivot of the world, so we've got to go back there. He talked about those elections in Berlin, and then there was the elections previous to that, from Chancellor Merkel's home territory, from her home region. And Friedman in this article talked about how that this is building to a crisis in German politics, how that the mainstream parties are being repudiated by a majority of voters, and this is significant. All of these right-wing and left-wing groups, far left-wing as well, so many Germans just dissatisfied with the major parties in Germany. Friedman said if the Berlin results are replicated on a national level, Germany's going to become ungovernable. You remember this quote? Ungovernable. He said Germany was moving toward a major political crisis that will resonate. Now, when I read that to you last week, I think it was, I referred you back to what Brad McDonald wrote at the Trumpet September 9th about the political crisis in Germany. He rattled off all the crises that the nation's facing, saying that it's a potentially dangerous scenario. And then he went back to some recent history leading up to World War II, how that by 1933 the public's frustration and anxiety was so intense, its hunger for better leadership so acute, that many Germans ignored Hitler the sociopath and instead embraced him as a superman who would soothe their anxieties and restore stability and order. Germany turned to a strong man back in the 1930s. Important history. Well, here's another piece by Project Syndicate on Europe's leadership crisis. Notice this. It says the European Union's list of crises keeps growing, just like Mr. McDonald rattled off in his piece. But beyond the United Kingdom's Brexit vote to leave the bloc, Poland's constitutional court imbroglio, Russian expansionism, migrants and refugees, and resurgent nationalism, the greatest threat to the EU comes from within. A crisis of political leadership is paralyzing its institutions. You've heard all the talk. We've discussed it on this program. The many crises, and then more recently, the discussions of in Europe about we need to get an army. We need to be unified when it comes to Europe's military. And of course, European leaders in many ways are becoming more vocal, more opinionated. There was a Deutsche Welle piece just last week, I think it was, where the German leader Steinmeier came out and was calling for a no-fly zone over Syria. I mean, just becoming more vocal. So on the one hand, you see that, but internally, there still hasn't been this strong man to emerge. That's what this piece is about at Project Syndicate. And it's paralyzing its institutions. They can't really move forward fast enough on these initiatives, on these so-called solutions. Unless they get the leader. It says here, meanwhile, Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi's refusal at the close of the summit, this is about the summit where they all came together, except for Britain. Britain's on the way out, as you know. But at this summit, the Italian Prime Minister, he chose not to appear on stage with the French President or the German Chancellor. And as this piece brings out, it just confirms the fears that rudderless leadership is fueling institutional dysfunction. There's no one to lead. They're all squabbling. It's a mixture, remember, iron and clay. And so there's infighting, there's division, there's strife. Project Syndicate says here, so now it faces a stark choice, a leap forward toward unification or inevitable disintegration. Now, Bible prophecy tells us where this is leading. You can read it for yourself in Daniel 2 and Revelation 17. You know it's coming together. There's going to be a shakeup. But you know the 10 are coming together. They're going to move forward toward greater unification. And they need a strong man to do it. Now, this piece from a week ago, well, what is today? I guess it was maybe 4 or 5 days ago, September 23rd. It's from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, a German publication, translated in our news bureau. The title, Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, The Return of a Fallen Star. He was in Berlin recently, and I mean to tell you, this paper, if our translation is accurate, this paper is just fawning over him, talking about his remarkable appearance in Berlin, how that as soon as he stepped to the podium, it seemed like he had never been gone, and it described how he looked, the jacket he was wearing, the three-day beard, and what his hair was like. It says here, but after just a few minutes of his speech, that is, he drew his audience into his spell, it says. His spell. Hardly anyone else could be more inspiring than the fallen New Hope who has kept his distance for so long. He's the fallen star. The plagiarism scandal from 2011, well, now it just seems like it was such a long time ago. He's been away for too long. It's time for him to come back. This article says here, yes, his fall has been abysmally self-inflicted and was caused by his own hubris, it says. And yes, it took a long time to overcome his vanity after his fall. He's paraphrasing what Gutenberg said. Quoting Gutenberg now, it says, I saw a land of unbridled critics and self-righteousness, but I was also ashamed and was suddenly afraid, even of myself. Today I know the criticism was more than justified. It says these are strong words of one who was always so self-confident. Perhaps even the humility which some of his followers would have liked to have seen from him in Gutenberg's old life. Now he's different, this fallen star. He's much more humble. He still, when he steps to the podium, it's like he never left. He can draw the audience into his spell. And now there's the humility. It says, since October 2015, Gutenberg has been a member of the competence team of the Bavarian Minister-President Horst Seehofer, who would be more than happy to attract him back to Bavaria to bask in his revived gleaming brilliance. But even more so, to prevent Marcus Söder's rise, well, it talks about some of the politics there in Bavaria. But let me see if I can get here to the end. It says this is a quoting Gutenberg from his speech in Berlin. What a time it was when one was still clear-cut, ousted because of riding off, he says. And then later, not a word was said on Merkel's refugee policy, so he didn't get into too much that was controversial. But then toward the end, it says, shortly after his appearance, Gutenberg had to give autographs, just like in the days when he was seen by many as the next chancellor. When he later ate in a nearby restaurant for lunch, some stood in line to shake his hand and to congratulate him, whether for his mere presence or his appearance or perhaps both. It says here, finally, as Zu Gutenberg stood on the podium a few minutes prior to this, an elderly gentleman wanted to urgently get rid of something. "Let us take your doctorate and stamp it into the garbage," he says, "and you can just come back to German politics." Gutenberg smiles. The compliment flatters him, and it quotes him as saying, "I like being a guest in Germany," he says, and smiles. Then he adds afterwards, "At some point, I'll be back. At some point, I'll be back." He appreciated the flattering remarks. Leave the doctorate scandal behind you. Stamp it onto the ground. Come back to Germany and draw in the audience into your spell. And he assured that older man and the audience there with him, "At some point, I'll be back." Well, as we've written before at the Trumpet, in many ways, if you look at what happened, that crisis for him, his personal crisis in 2011, I mean, he left public office. Talk about a blessing in disguise in many ways. He left public office just as the Greek debt crisis exploded and Southern Europe was thrown into turmoil. He left before so many of the other financial crises spread around the continent. He left before the Libyan crisis, before the crisis in Syria. Of course, the refugee crisis. And now he comes back from time to time. I think Brad McDonald mentioned that he's back in Germany, what, like once a month. And he likes being a guest in Germany. He likes visiting. But at some point, he'll be back. At some point, he'll be back. Could it be that he's the strong man in waiting? We'll have to wait and see. He's certainly a good candidate. The empire's already there, as my father has said. It's just waiting for the emperor. It's going to, as the Project Syndicate piece brought out, it's going to either take a leap forward toward unification or it will disintegrate. And your Bible says that it will unify more closely, more solidly than ever before. It'll unify. It already has politically. It already has economically. And now the discussion is underway for the military union. And yet still there's squabbling. Still there's a leadership crisis. And so Germany and the rest of Europe waits for the strong man to appear, and one that comes into office because of flatteries. A real smooth operator, you could say. Daniel 11:21. But what does it lead to? Going back to the first segment, I mean, some of those initial discussions when you kick them off and you think, well, this is surely the start of something significant. This is a groundbreaking ceremony. This is the first step to long-lasting peace. But that's not the way that this is going to play out. According to Daniel 8, it says in verse 24, "And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, It's referring to the strong man that's going to head up the resurrected Roman Empire in Europe. Of course, it's going to be a church-state union. So the great universal church, headquartered in Rome, it's going to be straddling this beast power. A great church-state union, the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. When the man appears, whenever it is, it's coming soon. When he appears, he's going to destroy wonderfully. That's what your Bible says. There's a great power behind this movement. There's a great power behind it. Verse 25 says, "And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in the land, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many." Lots and lots of talk of peace. "And by peace shall destroy many." Well, so many other prophecies, of course, relate to this crisis at the close. The whole world is going to be drawn into this conflict. That's why we keep talking about what's happening in and around Jerusalem, in the little Jewish state, in the heart of Germany, in the heart of Europe. That's why we keep talking about Brexit and the decline of Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain. That's why we keep our eye on Russia and Ukraine and China and the South China Sea. Because all of this factors in to this crisis at the close. And it culminates, as we read to you yesterday, I believe it was, Matthew 24 there, where Jesus talks about the great tribulation. And now that it leads right into, if you keep reading, 7-8 verses on, it leads right into Christ's return to this earth as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Stephen Fleury with TDRS, another one in the bag. Email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.